Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 214, and it's the third episode in a wander covering Joseph Miltier and the racist right-wing militant forces that permeated certain aspects of our culture and our country, and especially in the South during that period of our history in the 1950s and 60s. It's a terrifying yet fascinating wander on this subject of the forces that were shaping our country at that moment in time, particularly as the South was beginning to awake from 100 years of coexistence under Jim Crow laws and a staunch and long-standing cultural resistance to integration. A 100-year period after our country fought its only Civil War and freed the slaves. And it's some 60 years after minimal progress, which occurred under the basic concept of separate but equal, and a reality that no matter how separate things were, there was, at least not yet, anything close to equal in the equation. And be patient here, because this wander into a dark part of our history is necessary, because all of this ultimately fits into the story of the JFK assassination, both directly and indirectly. We owe a lot to a handful of people who dug deeply to uncover the true story of Joseph Miltier. Joseph Miltier was a racist, pure and simple, and he holds a unique place in the history of the JFK case. He is not some random racist who just happened to predict the Kennedy assassination, a foot fault, if you will, in the annals of the FBI. No, no, no. There is much more here than meets the eye. Most of us listening today are familiar with Harold Weisberg. Were it not for famous JFK assassination researcher Harold Weisberg, we would not have the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA. And without FOIA, the tape of Joseph Miltier cavalierly describing the exact conditions under which President Kennedy would be ultimately assassinated, well, it may never have seen the light of day. That tape was unearthed in 1967 as a result of Weisberg's exhaustive efforts in the early years after the assassination, efforts to force the government to pry loose of its precious documents and evidence, evidence that revealed so much. Not long after the Chicago plots were more fully reported on by Edwin Black, you can then close your eyes and fast forward to 1975. When Dan Christensen, writing for Miami Magazine, would resurrect the investigative reporting that had once again swung into gear, motivated perhaps by Edwin Black's in-depth reveal about the Chicago plot. And these were events and stories that came right on the heels of each other in November of 1963. The Miltier conversation recorded just a week, just 7 days after what happened in Chicago. It began to define the pattern of evidence, the pattern of a plot, which was beginning to develop right before the eyes of the authorities. After Dan Christensen wrote his articles in 1975, then came other JFK researchers and authors along the way, such as Lamar Waldron and Larry Hancock, both of which write and report on important elements related to this man, Miltier. One of the most important persons you've heard from in all of this is a stand-up FBI agent, Don Adams. Adams was the junior agent who had been reassigned in 1963 from the Atlanta office of the FBI and sent down to Thomasville, Georgia. He landed in just the spot down in South Georgia that he would be handed the assignment to investigate Miltier. And what he experienced, well, you have begun to hear. When we introduced Don Adams into the storytell in our last Miltier episode, well, as far as the investigation goes, that episode was a real commentary on how it was in the FBI at that time in 1963. But remember something important here. The FBI was like any organization of its time. In some ways, it was a microcosm of sorts of how society was in that moment. how races and people felt about each other, how the racism was both overt and covert. It showed in the investigation, and that is what you felt when you heard that story told by Don Adams. The story of Sheriff Elliott, a skeptical man of the South, skeptical of a man of the North. Much has changed in the world since then. Much has changed in the South since then, around these topics and many more that you are about to hear about. And thank goodness it has. But sadly, some things remain as challenges of race in our society. My point here is a simple one, though. Whatever you might have thought present in the FBI in terms of racial bias at that moment in 1963, well, multiply that by a very large factor regarding society at large, and especially in the South at that moment. But as usual, we are getting a little ahead of ourselves here, aren't we? Oh, well, that's the way it is on this podcast. Maybe it's time to go on a bit of a wander before we get on to the rest of our Miltier story. But trust me, the Miltier story is like tugging on a loose thread in your cotton sock. It's going to lead to much more. The Miltier story sets the plate, so to speak, for what is to be the overall backdrop of the day and the lens under which you should evaluate the behaviors and actions of those that lived in this time and in these enclaves of racism. Discrimination is a terrible thing, in whatever form it takes. I would hope that all of us can agree on that. No one, black, white, yellow or brown, male or female, young or old, this nationality or that nationality, none of us wants to be discriminated against. Yet we are all human, and human bias will always be present in some form or another, no matter how hard we guard against it. But let's be clear, falling short in the pursuit of perfection when it comes to an earnest attempt to avoid unnatural human bias, well, that seems like a rounding error compared to the ugly hatred and the racial violence and segregation that permeated the 100-year period after our country's Civil War in the 1860s. Some 600,000 men died in that war, our Civil War, more than twice what America lost in World War II. Lincoln's assassination in 1865 sadly put a stake in true Reconstruction and reconciliation. Real progress of accelerated integration was dashed with the acts of John Wilkes Booth and his conspirators. And then the steady rise of the Jim Crow South and similar elements of racism in the North would fill the next 100 years. Let's not be naive, though. Whether it was Lincoln or not in those first few years after the Civil War, the hearts of many in this country were many, many generations away from being cleansed of the racism that they grew up with in the most common of ways. Black men and women might not be on the plantation anymore, but their place in society had not moved an inch, for the most part, after emancipation. And the poverty that ensued with this social isolation and strangulation was like a match lit in a dry forest. The racism practiced by others was the gas on the fire, accelerating the flames and creating a raging heat that could destroy cities. And unquestionably, and perhaps ironically, that was exactly what some white racist fringe groups in this country wanted at the time. A rage by the black man so violent that it would invoke a justified response from the white race to declare war on the blacks of America. A justified race war. Of course, this is a completely twisted view of the world, I know, but this is what many fringe racist groups wanted to see happen. It was a path in their own twisted minds toward the eradication of blacks in this country. A race war to end all race wars. The question of equal rights would finally and inevitably rear its head once again in the 1950s and 1960s in this country. It took 100 years after emancipation to really start to turn the corner, and Kennedy was the first modern president to take it head on. The real history of it may very well have been that Kennedy was just thrust into the cauldron of it all, at just the moment in history when the waters of segregation and civil rights came to a boil. And so, like it or not, he had no choice, because doing nothing was not an option anymore, as it might have been for a President Eisenhower or a Truman. And on this topic, Kennedy was not a man to be frozen like a deer in the headlights. And that was even more of the case for his brother Bobby. No, it was time. The awakening came in a flurry and in many forms, all precipitated by events that were ripening all around him. The civil rights movement was in high gear, and Martin Luther King was leading its way. But even with such a leader, that ripening took time. It did not take place overnight. And perhaps many would say that after almost 100 years of Jim Crow laws, segregation, and discrimination, a pivotal point occurred in the landmark decision of the United States Supreme Court in 1954. The decision of Brown versus the Board of Education, the decision that reversed almost 60 years of separate but equal. Separate but equal that was defined by a previous landmark Supreme Court decision handed down in Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. The Brown decision may have been about desegregating schools, but the conceptual pivot which sprung from Brown versus the Board of Education was much more far-reaching. It was the basic underpinning of a broad shift toward a new equality in the eyes of the Supreme Court, and that meant that every Jim Crow law in the land was now at risk, separate but equal in everything from schools to water fountains. Separate but equal for everything was about to be declared dead, because equality in the eyes of the court was now in the hands of men that no longer saw it in the same way. It was, in short, an iteration of freedom in this country that was 100 years overdue. Only thing was, a lot of plain folk plainly didn't see it that way. You have to appreciate the level of struggle and the level of tension that goes on societally when massive shifts like this are underway. Despite Brown versus the Board of Education decision being the law of the land handed down by the Supreme Court, it was not rigorously enforced during the Eisenhower administration. Those ensuing years between the decision in 1954 and the election of President Kennedy in 1960 would be the start of the gestation period that would accelerate after Kennedy's election and finally gave birth to the explosion, which finally landed on Kennedy's doorstep in 1963, amongst so much other turmoil. It was a steady rise in civil rights activism by blacks and a similar rise in white resistance action groups whose aim was to rigorously resist what was coming. As the cadence of these two armies marched forward, it was inevitable that some form of a second civil war of sorts, so to speak, was looming on the horizon, and it was the fringe elements of the white resistance and white supremacy movements that turned to violence and murder more broadly in order to resist a way of life that was foreign and frightening to them, and to which they felt inalienably entitled to under the rights of this country and the endowments that they saw as God-given, and that had been provided to them as white men of superior standing in the eyes of their own Lord. Culturally, this was so embedded that it was a way of thinking, handed down generation to generation, for more than just the fringe elements. And that was sadly so for a very long time. While there was a difference between those who sought purely segregation without violence and those that sought more than that, both groups tolerated the terrorist indiscretions of those on the fringe until there came a moment when the terrorist element became too horrific for those indifferent to it. Too horrific to ignore it any longer, and especially when the rest of the nation and the rest of the world got a chance to peer in and see the shamefulness of it all. As when Bull Connor in Birmingham turned his fire hoses on the innocent to quell domestic disturbances that arose from simple demonstrations and civil disobediences of the moment. But every great cause needs a great leader, and one came along at just the right time. Martin Luther King's steady rise as the head of the civil rights movement would be galvanizing, but it was once again the steady application of terror by white supremacists that finally and shamefully brought demise to its own resistance. Amongst the brilliant strategy of nonviolence within King's civil rights movement. For so many in the South, this was a highly uncertain time. They had been handed down an almost sacred way of life for as many generations as anyone could remember, with the black man occupying a separate and disconnected place in society. Segregation for them was considered culturally required, if not actually God's directive. That's just the way it was. No reason to mix. The South was in a peculiar place after the Civil War. Blacks in America after the Civil War constituted somewhere between 12 and 16% of our population overall, depending upon what source you use. And the number is closer to 12% today. But the relative populations in each state, and especially the concentration in the South during those early years after the Civil War, is what impacts the story. With many northern states showing very small percentage of blacks comprising their population. But in southern states that had depended on slavery prior to the Civil War, the black populations post-war were upwards of as much as 45% in Alabama and as much as 65% in Mississippi, using some estimates. And in many places in the South, they remain highly concentrated even today. This represented a real risk in the minds of white Southerners at that time, that if blacks were ever allowed to vote or gain any foothold generally in mainstream society, that they could begin to not only have significant influence over things generally, but in a worst-case scenario, take control of local governments by utilizing their combined voting power. And that meant taking control of local sheriff's offices and local law enforcement and local judges and local courts. The thought of something like this happening, and especially the thought of such a thing to the average white Southerner in the 1950s, after almost 100 years of Jim Crow oppression of the black man, was, well, almost incomprehensible. It would literally flip their worlds upside down, and the thought of their children commingling together, black and white, was a core and divisive and fundamental issue to white Southerners who believed in segregation. Because, after all, keeping the children separate was fundamental to maintaining the status quo, or breaking it. Because, well, you know how kids are. Well, at least we know how they are before they are brainwashed by us adults. I know this is all hard to believe in the year 2024, but peering back in time, it is our history, and it was an ugly history at that moment. And we really have to understand how embedded and how impactful this decaying cultural element was to a dying way of life. This last bastion of a generally segregated and racist portion of our society, and how society as a whole was reacting to all of it at that very moment. And how important it all would be in our attempt to understand its impact in juxtaposition in the JFK assassination. Blacks had largely been reticent up to the 1950s on this racial divide, living separately but mustering little overall challenge to this highly segregated society. But World War II changed things. Black men fighting alongside white men in the military, shedding blood for this country, overseas, putting their lives on the line for this country, and then coming home without a vote, well, they no longer viewed that trade-off as tolerable. The war was, in many ways, a fuse that lit civil rights for many groups in this country, from Rosie the Riveter to blacks in Birmingham. Let's take a moment to understand some of the most important civil rights events of the 1950s and 60s as we set the plate for the mood of the country and what happens next in the story that is JFK. Let's pick up the history shortly after the end of World War II. In 1947, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit Court ruled that forced segregation of Mexican Americans into separate Mexican schools was unconstitutional and unlawful. Many folks don't know that the first color barrier broken in the South was all the way back in 1948, and it was by a man named Silas Herbert Hunt. He would break the color barrier at the University of Arkansas Law School. Many people still remember how segregated things like the Miss America pageant were in the day. If you go back to 1950, they operated under their famous Rule Number 7. It would plainly read, "The contestants must be of good health and of the white race." That same year, there was a federal case ruling that segregation was not allowable on railway dining cars because it violated the Interstate Commerce Act. By 1952, parents and children were also getting more involved. The NAACP filed at least 5 lawsuits that year related to school segregation matters. 1954 was, of course, the crescendo in some ways and the moment of pivot, because in May 1954, the landmark decision came down, Brown versus the Board of Education. No less than 15 major or key events curtailing segregation in various geographies occurred in 1954, and most of them were school-related. In 1955, the federal government as a whole began to take a lead, and President Eisenhower signed Executive Order 10590. It would establish a presidential committee whose objective was to enforce a non-discrimination policy as it related to federal employment. 1955 also saw a famous bus moment, perhaps not as famous as one that would happen a few months later. Nevertheless, it still went down as important in the annals of civil rights history. It was a young 15-year-old Claudette Colvin who refused to give up her seat on the bus to a white woman. Not long after that, murders began to appear in the picture. Preacher George W. Lee, who was a member of the regional NAACP council, was murdered in Belzoni, Mississippi. Meanwhile, over in Georgia, the Georgia Board of Education ordered that any teacher supporting integration would be fired. And 3 weeks later, the same Georgia Board of Education would fire all black teachers who were members of the NAACP. The long, hot summer days of August would see another uptick in murder. Another activist, Lamar Smith, was murdered in Brookhaven, Mississippi. And then, on August 28th, Emmett Till is killed for allegedly whistling at a white woman in Money, Mississippi. The story of Emmett Till is so important to the movement that it's worth saying just a little bit more about the entire event. Emmett Till was a boy, a 14-year-old boy, who was abducted, tortured, and lynched. The brutality of his murder and the acquittal of his killers drew attention to the long history of violent persecution of black men, particularly in Mississippi. Till was actually born and raised in Chicago. 14 years old, he would come down for the summer vacation in August 1955, visiting some relatives that lived near Money, Mississippi. It's a small town in the Mississippi Delta region. He just happened to be at a local grocery store one day while he was on vacation. And he had the real misfortune of interacting with a 21-year-old married white woman named Carolyn Bryant. She happened to be the local proprietor of the grocery store itself. No one is really sure about the exact events that happened at the store that day. To some extent, there's still a matter of dispute. Till is not here to tell his side of the story. But he was accused of flirting and actually touching Carolyn Bryant, and certainly whistling at her. Till's interaction with Bryant, perhaps unwittingly, violated the absolute unwritten code of behavior for a black male interacting with a white female in that Jim Crow part of the South. What happened next is the real tragedy. Several nights after the encounter, Bryant's husband, Roy, and his half-brother, J.W. Millam, both armed themselves and went down to Till's great-uncle's house, where Till was staying on vacation, and they abducted Emmett. They beat him, and they mutilated him And they did all that before they shot him right in the head. And they weren't done yet. They would sink his body in the Tallahatchie River. It would float down the river, and 3 days later, the boy's mutilated and bloated body was discovered and retrieved from the river. This young 14-year-old would be returned to Chicago, where his mother insisted on a public funeral with an open casket. That open casket allowed the world to see this little 14-year-old boy's bloated, mutilated body. There were tens of thousands who attended his funeral, and many of them viewed his open casket. And the images of that mutilated body were published in black-oriented magazines and newspapers. It was a clarion call to both blacks and whites, and there was sympathy broad-based across the United States. It brought to bear a fundamental thing: the basic lack of civil rights for black men and women in Mississippi. And sadly, not more than just about a month later, in September 1955, an all-white jury found Bryant and Milam not guilty of Till's murder. Of course, after that verdict, they were protected against double jeopardy. And those two men very brazenly and publicly admitted in a 1956 interview with Look magazine that they had in fact tortured and murdered the boy. They sold the story of how they did it for about $4,000. There is no doubt that Emmett Till's murder was a catalyst for the next phase of the civil rights movement. In November 1954, the Interstate Commerce Commission banned bus segregation in interstate travel. And on the same day, the U.S. Supreme Court banned segregation in public parks and playgrounds. The Georgia governor at the time was a man named Marvin Griffin, and he would glibly respond that the state would, and I quote, "get out of the park business," rather than allowing playgrounds to be desegregated. To round out 1955, the now famous Rosa Parks refuses to give up her seat on a bus, starting the Montgomery bus boycott. This more famous bus boycott event happened about 9 months after Claudette Colvin became the first to refuse to give up her seat. In January 1956, the governors of four states agreed to block the integration of schools. It was Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Virginia. They all joined in on this one. Surprisingly, Alabama was not a co-conspirator yet. In that same month, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover would write a rare open letter after a civil rights leader, T.R.M. Howard, charged in a speech that he made that the FBI could, and I quote, "pick up pieces of a fallen airplane on the slopes of a Colorado mountain and find the man who caused the crash, but they couldn't find a white man when he kills a Negro in the South." In February of 1956, the Virginia Assembly passed a resolution which stated that the decisions passed by the United States Supreme Court on integration constituted illegal encroachment upon their rights. In that same month, the University of Alabama admitted their first black student, Arthur and Lucy. And whites engage in riots for days right afterward. Miss Lucy is eventually expelled herself for engaging in the suit filed against the university. Oh, a little more P.S. on Miss Lucci. While she only attended class for 3 days before she was expelled, Lucy would later again sue the university for violating her civil rights. And in 1988, the university readmitted her, and she successfully completed her degree in education. Just another amazing example of what happens when you stay at it. In the February and March timeframe, probably perhaps one of the most important developments occurred, and that was the development of the Southern Manifesto, opposing integration of schools, that was drafted and signed by members of the congressional delegations of a number of Southern states, including 19 members of the Senate and 81 members of the House of Representatives at the federal level, notably the entire delegation of the states of Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, in Virginia. And on March 12th, the manifesto was released to the press. Yes, things were going fast and furious in 1956. In March, the Alabama legislature followed on and voted to ask for federal funds to deport blacks to northern cities. In March, Martin Luther King was sentenced to a fine or jail for instigating Montgomery bus boycotts, which was actually suspended pending his appeal of the case. In April 1956, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down segregation on buses nationwide. In May 1956, Circuit Judge Walter P. Jones issued an injunction prohibiting the NAACP from operating at all in Alabama. And just a month later, in June, the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights was formed in Birmingham. By December of 1956, federal marshals were on site to enforce the Supreme Court ruling to desegregate the buses in Montgomery. And at just about the same time in 1956, the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission was formed. Let me say a little bit more about the Sovereignty Commission. The Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission was a state agency established in 1956 by the Mississippi state government with the goal of preserving segregation and promoting white supremacy in the state. The commission worked to monitor and suppress civil rights activities, infiltrate civil rights organizations, and maintain the racial status quo in Mississippi. The commission was involved in spying on civil rights activists, black leaders, and other individuals considered to be threats to the segregationist way of life in the state. If you can believe it, the commission was actually in place all the way up to 1977, the year it was disbanded. By the end of 1956, things had gotten so crazy that J. Edgar Hoover had initiated the COINTELPRO program. This is another one of those things that's probably worth a little bit of a quick explanation of. COINTELPRO is short for Counterintelligence Program. It was a series of covert and primarily illegal projects conducted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the United States from the time it was assembled in 1956 all the way through actually the 1970s. COINTELPRO was aimed at surveilling, infiltrating, discrediting, and disrupting various political organizations and movements deemed subversive or threatening to the established order. Targets included civil rights organizations, anti-war groups, later on socialist and communist organizations, and really any other dissenting voices to the government. COINTEL tactics sometimes included harassment, intimidation, wiretapping, planting false or misleading information about a person or an organization, and they would incite violence between groups at times. The program was eventually criticized for violating the civil liberties and the constitutional rights of American citizens. Later on, revelations about COINTELPRO and all the activities around it would lead to public outrage and congressional investigations, ultimately resulting in some reforms in federal law enforcement practices. 1956 was surely an explosion of events, and the pace and intensity of events would pick up from there. 1957 also got off to a banner start. In February, the Georgia Senate voted to declare the 14th and the 15th Amendments to the United States Constitution null and void. For those of you who don't recall exactly what the 14th and 15th Amendments are all about in our Constitution, well, they represent significant changes that were adopted during Reconstruction, right after the Civil War period. These amendments sought to address issues of civil rights, equality, and citizenship for newly freed African Americans in the aftermath of slavery and the abolition of the institution. The 14th Amendment very specifically addressed citizenship and equal protection under the law. It granted citizenship to all persons born or naturalized in the United States, including former slaves. The Equal Protection Clause was really important. It ensured that states could not deny any person within their jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. The 15th Amendment addressed voting rights and prohibited the denial of voting rights based on race or color or previous condition of servitude. It granted African American men the right to vote and aimed to protect their voting rights from discrimination and suppression. The interesting thing about the 15th Amendment, it certainly represented a significant step forward toward universal suffrage. However, it didn't address some of the other forms of discrimination or barriers that kept people from voting, things like poll taxes, literacy tests, and, of course, intimidation tactics. In that same state, in that same month, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was formed, and Martin Luther King was named as chairman. 2 months later, in April, the Florida Senate voted to consider U.S. Supreme Court's desegregation decisions null and void. And then the following month after that, in May, there would be a prayer pilgrimage for freedom in Washington, D.C., at which Martin Luther King would give his very famous Give Us the Ballot speech. And at that time, it was the largest nonviolent demonstration for civil rights yet. Now we get to September 1957, and Orville Faubus, who was the governor of Arkansas, would call out the National Guard to block integration of Little Rock Central High School. Later that month, President Eisenhower would federalize that same National Guard, and he would also order U.S. Army troops to ensure that Little Rock Central High School in Arkansas was integrated. Federal and national troops escorted what was known then as the Little Rock Nine, nine students there that became a pretty famous group in the history of the civil rights movement. They would escort them into Little Rock High School. This group was met with really violent opposition, and they faced harassment, threats, intimidation from segregationist mobs and local authorities. These nine young black youth, like Emmett Till, held an important place in the history of advancements made during this time frame. With as much turmoil as the nation was feeling around the issue of school integration, on September 15th, the New York Times reported that in 3 years since the decision, there had been minimal progress toward integration in four of the southern states and actually no progress at all in seven others. Right after the Little Rock incident, on September 27th, Eisenhower would sign the first Civil Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act of 1957. And it was about a month later that officers at the NAACP would be arrested in Little Rock for failing to comply with a new financial disclosure ordinance. Imagine that. In November 1957, just to finish out the year, the Texas legislature voted to close any school where federal troops might be sent. And this action actually had become what was now somewhat a recurring theme heard around many state legislatures across the South. By the end of 1958, things were heating up on the political scene. Opposition in the South to integration translated very precisely into actions over the entire political landscape. State legislatures were rejecting federal jurisdiction, let alone involvement in segregation matters, and there was broad-based political support for resisting federal intervention in state and local affairs. It was a showdown that was escalating on all fronts. 1959 seemed quieter for a moment, but the year couldn't squeak by without the Alabama legislature passing a law to limit black voter registration. Well, once again, it's getting late, and I'm getting hungry, and it's time for a sandwich. So we'll take a pause here, and we'll pick it back up in the next episode in 1960. Thank you for listening to episode 214 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.